My guest today, Jeffrey St. Clair, is an investigative journalist, writer, and editor, best known as the editor of the irreverent online and paper edition of the political newsletter Counterpunch, which he previously co-edited with our late friend Alexander Coburn. He has worked as an environmental organizer and writer for Friends of the Earth, Clean Water Action Project, and the Hoosier Environmental Council back in Indiana, and in 1990 moved from Indiana to Oregon to edit the influential environmental magazine Forest Watch, and has remained in Oregon ever since. In 1998, he published his first book with Coburn, Whiteout, The CIA, Drugs, and the Press, a history of the CIA's tugs to drug gangs from World War II to the Mujahideen and Nicaraguan Contras. This was followed by A Field Guide to Environmental Bad Guys with James Ridgway, 5 Days That Shook the World, Seattle and Beyond, Al Gore, A User's Manual, and Been Brown So Long It Looked Like Green to Me, The Politics of Nature, and Born Under a Bad Sky, Notes from the Dark Side of the Earth. Welcome, Jeffrey St. Clair, to Takes on the World.
Hey, great to be here, Jeffrey. How are you?
Great to have you back. It's been a while, but here we are again, 8 weeks from another presidential election, and faced with a choice of the lesser of two evils, and despite the efforts of the Democratic National Committee to sabotage the Bernie Sanders campaign, exposed by WikiLeaks, organizations on the liberal left are cudgeling people to vote for what is observably the most openly hawkish candidate to ever run for president on the simply because she's not Donald Trump. But wouldn't this be the case no matter who is heading the Republican ticket?
Of course. We've seen it all before, haven't we? We've seen it with McCain. We've seen it with Romney, Bush. It's the lesser of two evils strategy. And we've been voting for, I guess, the lesser evil. I think at this point you would need a political calculator to do standard deviations to detect just how lesser Hillary is than the other evil. But when you vote for evil, you're voting for evil. And I think we've now reached that point where Hillary is the sort of Frankenstein monster that lesser evil voting has created. By any other standard, you wouldn't even call her a Democrat. And, I don't see Democrats as being particularly progressive. But she's a new Democrat who's really, an old Republican. I mean, she did start out as a Goldwater girl, and she's made the complete transformation, I guess, into the woman from Goldman Sachs.
Well, even Maureen Dowd, New York Times, back on August 13th, called her the perfect GOP nominee. She says Republicans have their candidate. It's Hillary, and she talks about her mutual affection with Henry Kissinger, with John Negroponte, some of the most evil people who have come across the American political spectrum. But notice, or I've noticed, in all her public speeches and in debates, but in public speeches, she only talks about domestic policy and limits her foreign policy talk to pro-Israel think tanks. And so people are voting thinking that, she's going to do this with health care or help reduce the debt of students in debt or the college debt. But in fact, she is being backed by the leading neocons who brought us the Iraq War.
Well, of course she is. I mean, she helped bring us the Iraq War. Don't forget that. And in fact, her husband's administration, which she was a co-pilot of, I guess there were two co-pilots, her and Gore, both of them incredibly hawkish. People think, particularly Democrats, like to seduce themselves into thinking that the Iraq War started with George W. Bush. Well, the Iraq War has been going on now for, more than 20 years. And during the Clinton administration, Iraq was bombed once every 3 days. And she was fully behind that. We also had a sanctions regime, just a vicious sanctions regime, imposed upon Iraq by the State Department under the auspices of Madeleine Albright, that killed at least 500,000 Iraqi children and probably, upwards of 1 million Iraqis And, in a rare episode of, journalistic integrity, it's that Albright was asked, I think it was by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, about this fact that Americans were completely unaware of the toll of the sanctions on Iraqi civilians, 500,000 dead children, a million dead civilians, was the price worth it? And Albright infamously, and honestly said, yes, we believe it was. And of course, Hillary fully supported that. In fact, that Albright foreign policy template is what they've now been rebranded as smart power. And that's Hillary's, foreign policy agenda. We now have 13 wars going on. The press rarely reports that. And she wants to expand it. I think if her belligerent attitude toward Russia, toward Syria, Iran, China, it's incredibly hawkish. And, the big story in the Washington papers this morning is the fact that defense contractors are flushing money into the Clinton campaign. She has received twice the number of defense contractor political contributions as the Trump campaign. And that really tells you everything you need to know about where the D.C. foreign policy and war machine is investing its money.
Well, it seems to be she has a number of choices. One of the documents I read this morning that had been earlier released by WikiLeaks talked about her wanting to overthrow the Assad regime, not for the benefit of the Syrian people or even for the United States, but for the benefit of Israel. And then, of course, she's been pushing for a large NATO and confrontation with Vladimir Putin, who she has compared with Hitler. And then, of course, even though Obama has a lot of blood on his hands, more so than most people are aware of, even he wanted to make a deal with Iran rather than go to war. But it's very clear that Clinton, obviously, she reluctantly supported the Iran deal. But her statements about Iran are basically right out of the mouths of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, of course they are. And let's not forget that Hillary was asked about dealing with Iran, and she left the nuclear option on the table. People talk about how they're worried about Trump's, nuclear weapons policy and, can we trust his finger on the button? And here we have Hillary Clinton publicly stating that she would consider using, the so-called bunker buster nuclear weapons against Iran. And, that should really send a chill down your spine because, we know she means it. Trump, who knows what he means, but we know, to take her at her word on those kind of foreign policy issues because her audience is, as you say, not so much the American public, but IPAC and Israel on those, on those sacred issues, which I don't think she will backpedal from.
Well, she has written, not in the New York Times, as would ordinarily be the case. She has written in the Weekly Jewish Forward that on her first day in office, she would invite Netanyahu to come to Washington and send the U.S. general military staff to Israel to consult with their counterparts in Israel to determine what they needed to defend themselves beyond this huge $45 billion arms deal they're about to get. But this never makes the mainstream newspaper. It never is mentioned in any of her speeches, and the American public, the people who are concerned with domestic issues, have no idea that this is her real agenda. And she obviously is critical. She wants to reset the U.S.-Israel relationship, which has been damaged under President Obama. it's quite interesting that in that regard. Trump, on the other hand, as you say, we don't know what he's going to do, and he's clueless in terms of knowledge. But as I pointed out earlier, before I called you, the documents do show that both Clinton and Obama were in on the pushing of jihadists in Syria that formed the Islamic State. So he was more right than he probably even knows. But certainly the media didn't even countenance the possibility or even discuss the U.S. role in building the Islamic State and the role of our allies in doing so.
No, they just want to caricature Trump as a cartoonish figure, and of course he, you know, he plays right into to that stereotype. But you know, I mean, let's remember that Trump uttered what are always fatal words in American politics, which was that he wanted to deal even-handedly between Israel and the Palestinians and other interests in the Middle East. And even-handedness cannot be tolerated among the foreign policy elite. And he was smacked down for that. And in a way, he's never recovered because I think in many ways, from my point of view, admirable views against interventionism, about reforming, if not doing away with NATO. These are all things that ought to be on the table, but aren't. And one of the reasons is that he wants to, you know, he says he wanted to be an honest, even-handed broker in the Middle East, and that's just not going to be tolerated.
Well, it's interesting. The last politician who did that was a man named Howard Dean. Howard Dean was running a very successful candidacy for the U.S. presidency when he said the very same thing that Trump did. He wanted to be more even-handed in dealing with Israel and Palestine. He got jumped on by John Kerry, by Nancy Pelosi, by the whole Jewish establishment, and he backed off. And then since then, he's become a loyal enforcer for the pro-Israel lobby. And he's was rewarded by being made at the time the head of the Democratic National Committee to do that very thing. So you can't actually say that. There are no members of Congress that could even stand up and say that. They can express pity for the Palestinians suffering in Gaza, but they can't really put blame on Israel, and you could easily attack a U.S. president, but no politician, including Barbara Lee in Berkeley, for example, who even though she supports or she opposes the Palestinian, she says she opposes the occupation, she opposes the siege of Gaza, and she opposes Jewish settlements. She was appointed by Debbie Wasserman Schultz to be on the Democratic Platform Committee, and she was the one who cast the vote that prevented the Platform Committee from making any statement criticizing, even mentioning Israel's occupation or the settlements. So it's a very heavy, heavy hand, and that comes from the source of the main funding for the Democratic Party.
Well, it's like they're sent off to re-education camps, isn't it? Because let's remember that Hillary had her own very harsh lesson when, I believe it was when she was just beginning her Senate campaign in New York State, and may have been the New York Post ran front page photo of her kissing Yasser Arafat on the cheek.
His wife, his wife.
And they had, and she was, I mean, which is kind of a standard greeting at you know, White House affairs. But she was made, you know, it was as if they'd had an affair or something, which she had to renounce. And do more than renounce. She had to flip, you know, all the way over and sort of become, you know, just to pledge her fealty to the Israeli state and IPAC. I mean, it's really quite stunning, and it happens over and over again. So she learned her lesson early on, and she's now It's like you undergo Pavlovian conditioning or something. And there she is.
Well, the same thing actually happened to Elizabeth Warren, who learned early on, after making all these wonderful statements criticizing the U.S. corporations and how people were being fleeced by the government here, she came out with a statement and has repeated it, totally supporting and probably written by AIPAC. But most Americans don't know when someone's running for Congress, whether the House or the Senate, in either the Democratic or Republican Party, they're paid a visit by an AIPAC staff member to get a statement supporting Israel, and if they don't want to write it themselves, AIPAC staff members will be very happy to do it for them. That's why so many statements sound alike. And they very rarely appear on the politicians' websites because most people in the United States really have other interests in their life than what's happening in Israel or Palestine. But that's not where their money comes from. It doesn't come from the ordinary people. It comes from wealthy supporters in the Democratic Party who happen to be from Israel. And the estimated amount over at least the last half century from reliable sources is 60%. So the money talks in politics. There's no question about it. One thing, my guest is Jeffrey Sinclair, editor of Counterpunch. One thing that's really interesting about this campaign, because both candidates have such low poll numbers, and they keep getting lower and lower, and understandably why, that even the mainstream media started to pay attention to third-party candidates. And I was really quite amazed to see CNN, and you wrote about this, CNN a week ago tonight had a town hall meeting featuring Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, and Ajama Baraka, her vice presidential candidate. And you wrote favorably about that. Give us your take on that.
Well, I think, really, CNN, you know, has to be commended, and maybe it's because their ratings are so far in the dump that they're doing anything to try and restart them. But they have given the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who I know a little bit, and William Weld, his vice presidential candidate, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts. They gave them 90 minutes about a month ago, and then gave the Green Party 90 minutes last week. And I think it's commendable. I mean, we say this, well, you know, it's commendable. Wow, they're doing this. Well, you know, of course, this should be this should be a feature of every presidential election when you have, and I think that both the Greens and the Libertarians, they've been around a long time, you know, they should be considered legitimate third and independent parties, and they should have a public airing of their views, you know, every year, but of course they don't. And the Libertarians are a little bit better known than the Greens, I guess, who, you know, have the black mark of them, of Ralph Nader in 2000. Totally bogus charges that he cost Gore the election. But I said that it was like watching this, particularly Ajamu and Jill Stein, was the political equivalent of George Carlin's Seven Things That You Can't Say on Television. And that this must have been a mysterious event for many Americans who, you know, heard about, you know, our global network of military bases, you know, more than 850, that the CIA engages in assassination, that single payer is actually, you know, an economically viable option for healthcare in this country. These are things that you just don't hear discussed in the mainstream media, and it was really refreshing. And you had really two people in Jill Stein and Ajama who are very articulate, who speak very directly, and I thought it was wonderful. We probably will never see them again on mainstream media, but it was really a breath of fresh air, and I hope it does them some good.
It was interesting. Most Americans probably aren't aware of it. What Jill Stein brought up was who determines who participates in the national debates on for the president. And it isn't. It's both political. It's a Democrat and Republican party essentially decide that.
Sure. Now, you know, some of us, you and I, are old enough to remember when the presidential debates were hosted by the League of Women Voters, and they set the rules. They invited, you know, the candidates, and it got to be that things were getting a little bit out of hand. The questions were a little too piercing. The possibility of third and fourth party candidates getting up on the stage and hogging the spotlight was a little bit irritating. So they dropped the League of Women Voters, and they created the Democratic and the Republican parties created their own corporation, the Commission on Presidential Debates. Sounds official, but it's really that when you get behind it, it's the RNC and the DNC. And they set rules that are entirely favorable to the preservation of this, one monster with two heads, this duopoly of Republicans and Democrats. So effectively, since Ross Perot, his candidacy in 92 and 96, third parties have been kept out of the debate. And there have been, a lot of litigation. I think Ralph Nader has sued, two or three times. The Greens and the Libertarians again filed suit in federal court this year, and the ruling was we don't have any control over it. This is a private thing put on by this private corporation controlled by the Republicans and the Democrats. So yeah, it's all based toward preserving this increasingly fragile two-party system.
One of the things that's interesting is we saw with Obama and we see again with Clinton, that a number of former people who were quote-unquote identified as radicals, such as Tom Hayden or Carl Davidson, people don't know him, but within the left, or Bill Fletcher used to be with the CIO, they come out and become supporters kind of to rope in everyone to vote for the Democratic Party candidate. And they did that twice with Obama, despite his first term of drones, using drones and deporting people and cracking down whistleblowers. It doesn't really matter, these people. And Hayden is at it again. I knew Hayden, and I remember when he decided to join the system. And in 1982, he and Jane Fonda went over to Israel during their invasion of Lebanon and siege of Beirut, and visited with Israeli soldiers in the hospital and stood with them, with Israeli soldiers, as they besieged Beirut and refused to meet with Israeli peace activists back inside Israel. And Alexander wasn't... This is when Alexander was writing, Coburn was writing with James Ridgway for the Village Voice, and he wrote a column which began with, I remember, in the National Gallery in Washington, there are 46 portraits of Benedict Arnold. None of them look alike, yet they all resemble Tom Hayden.
Classic Alex, isn't it?
It was perfect. And then Gore Vidal said that Tom Hayden gave opportunism a bad name. And here he is again.
And their whole network, the progressive nonprofit industrial complex in America is dependent almost entirely on foundation funding. And they also have a symbiotic relationship with the Democratic Party. So their function, and I write about this in my column last week, is to keep the children in line, right? To keep the Bernie or Busters, the progressives in labor, the progressives in the environmental movement from leaving the reservation, and they resorted to really deplorable tactics. They've accused Jill Stein of absolutely without any credence at all of being anti-vaccination for children and anti-science. Now, Jill Stein graduated, I don't have that, you know, high regard for Harvard. They produce a lot of war criminals. She's not one of them. But she graduated magna cum laude from Harvard. She graduated with honors from the Harvard Medical School. She practiced medicine as an internist at Beth Israel Hospital for 25 years, and she taught medicine at Harvard Medical School. They're accusing this woman of being anti-science. And when that slur sort of lost some of its power, they've now resurrected another one, which is that she and Ajamu Baraka are Trotskyite cancers upon the political system. And so, yeah, they've reached really far down into their bag of dirty political tricks and come up with, you know, McCarthyite tactics.
Exactly.
Of the Red Scare. And it's just, you look at this and I'm just, it's stunning and it's appalling. And it's a real sign of just, to me, how politically and morally bankrupt the Clinton machine is, and in fact, the whole Democratic Party establishment, that they have to resort to these tactics in order to scare the sort of liberal left electorate into line and make them vote for someone who there's really no rational, progressive rationale to vote for. That's all they've got.
One of those people who I get emails from and I previously had some respect for is a fellow named Robert Nayman. I was bored to name him, but a group called Just Foreign Policy. And he sent out an email, which you put, I'm going to quote it from your article. He wrote, Robert Nayman did, "If you have a lot of Facebook friends, you may have recently noticed a high-level activity on your Facebook feed by Jill Stein acolytes. If so, you may find the following links useful to throw them off their game. No warranty express or implied. You don't have to prove that Jill Stein is an anti-science conspiracy theorist. You just have to say, quote, there are unanswered questions about whether Jill Stein is an anti-science conspiracy theorist, end quote. And then he has a number of questionable links. Now, this is McCarthyism at its worst. And and we're going to see this from MoveOn.org, all these groups that are ordinarily to the left of the Democratic Party will take good positions on some issues, number of issues. But when it comes to the elections, they act as sheepdogs, bringing right. in the sheep to vote, like William Lederer described the American people very aptly in 1953 in his book. That was before smartphones and computers and so on.
Exactly.
A nation of sheep. Right. We're a country, we're a people that believe that we are independent-minded acting, and yet we accept being reamed more readily than any developed or underdeveloped country I'm aware of. And maybe you're up in Oregon. How are things up there in terms of this campaign? Same thing?
It's the same thing. And you know, I mean, the ironic, you live in California. I live in Oregon. Hillary has a 98% to 99% chance of winning both of these states by double-digit numbers. There is absolutely no reason for any progressive in either of these states to have any pangs of guilt that their vote for an anti-war candidate, whether it's Gary Johnson or Jill Stein or, you know, writing in Ralph Nader's name, is going to affect the election, the ultimate election of Hillary, one bit. It's almost, you know, it's a sure thing at the national level, and certainly is in Oregon. But These tactics keep resurfacing because they really are desperate to keep people inside of the Democratic Party as the foundations of it are crumbling, in the same way that the foundations of the Republican Party are crumbling. And that's why I see this this air of desperation. You know, it's like the feeding trough is starting to leak really badly. And just about everyone, all the the nonprofits are feeding at the same trough, and I think they see, that the end might be coming. I hope so.
Just quickly, as we didn't get into it, one of the things that troubled me about the Bernie Sanders campaign is he actually went after Hillary with both hands tied behind his back. There was so much in her record that he didn't bring up, such as being a board member of Walmart, to her role in the Honduras coup, to her role in Haiti, the role of both Clintons in Haiti. That would have been damning, particularly in the Black community, Latino communities, and he didn't do this, obviously by choice. In the last couple of minutes, what do you have to say, what positive, negative about the Sanders campaign?
I think that the writer Michelle Alexander really said it best, and I agree with her 100%, that Sanders's revolution ended the moment that he decided to run in the Democratic Party, because he legitimized a party that is now completely beholden to neoliberal economic policy at home and imperialism abroad. And if you remember, at the very first debate, we saw that Sanders was not going to go after Hillary directly when she was asked, I believe, by Anderson Cooper about her email problem. And Sanders, chivalrously, I guess, he thought, sort of said, wait a minute, nobody gives a damn about these emails. Let's get off of that. I'm not going to make it an issue. And I think that told you right there that he was not going to go after Hillary on any of the issues that really mattered. And in fact, that was true. It was just stunning to me that he did not bring up her role in the Honduran coup, especially when during the course of the campaign, we saw indigenous environmental activists being assassinated before our eyes by thugs who were beholden to the ruling junta in Honduras that Hillary helped put into power.
And that woman, Bertha Cascasetas, had actually accused Clinton some months before that of being responsible for the coup.
Exactly. There it was. It was right there. And it seems to me, if you are he called himself a revolutionary. He wasn't. But, if you are a progressive, if you are a human rights activist, if you are someone who cares about democracy, that you would have raised that issue again and again, and you would have made it stick to Hillary, and you would have held her accountable. If Bernie wasn't going to hold her accountable, who was? And, that a great political and moral failing of his campaign, I think.
Well, Jeffrey, on that, that note, we've come to the end of the hour. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today. Counterpunch.org. Every day there's about 8 or 9, 10 articles about what's going on in the world from different perspectives, all progressive, provocative perspectives. I do recommend it. And thanks again for being our guest today on Takes on the World and keeping Counterpunch alive and thriving.
My pleasure, Jeff. Good to talk to you.
Take care. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.